Today is Friday. It's March 10th, 2023. This is part 12 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Alan spells his name A-L-L-E-N, last name M-A-L-M-Q-U-I-S-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Alan. How are you today?
I'm doing good, thank you. How are you?
Good, thank you. Alan, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. In our last discussion, you started talking quite a bit about Moccasin Tours, a packing company that you started, and you were doing pack trips kind of all over the West, up into the Wind Rivers in Wyoming and in Grand Canyon. I wanted to ask you about the Grand Canyon packing. Can you pick that thread up some?
Yes, I because it's where it made the transition between the concession packing at Whitmore to take the river runners out that we proposed and tried our best, but I eventually really didn't work out. I'd mentioned last time that it was just the logistics were difficult. There was no communication, and the summer heat was hard to deal with. So back in the we're talking about the late 70s here. Anyway, I really liked the idea of packing people around and showing them the canyon and especially, and then other areas that I'd visited around the West. 'Cause I think one of the earliest things I had mentioned to you, we had discussed one day, was when I was, in exploring the Western Grand Canyon on my first trip, that part of the problem was the Colin Fletcher, the hiker who had written the book by, Hiking the Grand Canyon. And
right, The Man Who Walked Through Time.
Man Who Walked Through Time. And I put my own subtitle on that was "And Live to Tell About It." he was everything was him overcoming the monster called wilderness, and the canyon was such an obstacle and fierce thing, and he succeeded. And my experience there was, this was a wonderful place that people just didn't appreciate, hadn't experienced, didn't know how to experience it. And I almost resented his books. I even saw him on TV once back then. And I just came away surprised at how different my attitude was from his. But in the back of everything I was doing, later in the 70s, was to figure out a way where I could get people into the desert hiking and just enjoying desert wilderness. The Sierra Club was truly a club for hiking the Sierra Nevada mountains, and what I was doing was something very different. That going into the canyon, which that really wasn't done. And so after the concession at Whitmore was coming down, I really was pleased to find that by default I had this experience and the animals and the support from the friends to keep doing it, and especially had contacts in the Sierra Club and I can't, I'll have trouble remembering them. But a good example, one of the first trips was down Parashant. And I, my first solo horse trip had been into the Western Canyons from Tuckup Canyon around the Esplanade to Toroweep, and then on to Whitmore Canyon moving west, and then into the rim overlooking Parashant.
Right.
And I then talked with the Bundys, because that whole area over there was his, was their historic area and grazing, even though they really didn't own the grazing rights at the time in the 70s, but it was definitely, they knew all about it because they were raised out there.
Right. Alan, and, who did you talk, yeah. Do you remember who you talked with? Which Bundys?
It would have been Chet.
And what do you remember about him?
He was the brand inspector for the Western Canyon there, and I lived in a house next to the Owen Johnson and Moccasin that was the brand inspector for the east side of the Arizona Strip, and they would, Bundy would come over, or I, or Owen would go over and meet up with him somewhere that a bunch of us would be along. And I would just ask about places, and one of them I'd ask about was Parashant. Can a string of horses get down to the river there?
Uh-huh.
And they said, oh, yeah, that's no problem. It's, you know, normal, rough, but it, they said it was a, well, at the time, you could not get down Kanab Canyon with horses.
Right.
In later years, you could, to my amazement, but the Bundys did go down Kanab Canyon.
Hmm.
And so I went around, and I, well, drove in my Bronco to the headwaters of Parashant, where they had a, the Bundys had a Jeep road that went down off the rim and to a corral. And then I hiked down to the river and back, and it was a really great trip. So some of the Sierra Club guys were asking me what I could do, and I suggested that.
Hey, Alan,
and, yeah.
There's a couple ways to drive into this area. One is west of the Whitmore Road. It's a totally different road, and comes down to the mine and the airport that was in there. And then the other route actually comes down, goes past the airport that you built there, the runway, and then down to the, almost to the Whitmore Trail, but not quite. There's a, not, you bypass all the rugged parts, and there's a road that goes around and approaches Parashant from the east at Frog Springs.
Right.
Is that how you were coming in from the east, or were you coming in from the west?
Well, I've done it, well, not from the west, but always from the east and from the north.
Okay.
And when I was exploring it, I was coming in from the west. And just the way you described it, I never drove around to the saddle, but the lower saddle between Whitmore and Parashant, but I walked that several times.
Okay.
And then there was an old trail that continued down to Parashant from that saddle, but it was pretty rugged, and I couldn't see getting a group in or out that way for any reason.
Okay.
And but I came in the upper, well, from Bundyville, you went a little south and a little west and came off the rim down into the headwaters of Parashat.
Got it.
It was maybe, well, it would be on the Esplanade down there, but I know that in the past there had been a jeep road to that copper mine, and they had a on the west side of Parashat. But when I was going there, the only passable route was in from Bundyville down to the corral there, which was good for my purposes.
Okay.
And the group, it was a one-week trip, and the group, we actually met at that corral, which meant that they all had four-wheel drive of some kind, and the group, they all doubled up with, shared the driving from wherever they met. I don't recall if they probably met in St. George and then carpooled down in the four-wheel drives, because you definitely had to have that. And then I met them there.
And how many people came in?
There could have been 16 to 18.
Okay.
It was a pretty large group for that type of activity.
Yep.
And we went down a long first day, really, because there was no water along Parashat until you get near the river, and then the stream was just a small stream there. So we had to get all the way to the river the first day. And what I don't remember is if they almost had to have spent the night there beforehand. I just don't recall that they had to, because we had to pack everything up and then walk all the way down there.
Right.
And it was kind of uneventful getting there. It was just a really nice trip. The canyon's great for people who haven't been hiking down the Grand Canyon canyons on the off the North Rim. It was they were just beside themselves at what a great place they had gone through.
Cool. Do you remember what time of year this was? Was it?
It was spring.
Springtime. Okay.
In fact, it was early March.
Okay.
And we got down there, and then the way I had it set up that worked good for me is, well, I have to mention, I'd forgotten already, that before the group got there the day before, I had, gotten all the livestock and all the boxes of food, and packed all the boxes of food down to the Colorado, cached them in the bottom of the cliff there, the place and where it was safe, and then came back up and met the group. So that's why I was trying to think how they got in there. Well, I was busy that day, so I didn't have anything to do with it.
And were they going to ride the stock, or were they going to walk in and you're carrying their packs with your stock?
They're going to walk in, and I carried the packs. Each person had a duffel bag, a certain size and weight, and they could put anything they wanted in there.
Okay.
And were encouraged not to carry anything but a small day pack to carry the lunch with them. But they could have, some had camera gears, some had went very light, but it was the people who was hiking it was advertised as hiking and the pack stock carrying all your gear.
And did you bring your camera? Were you taking pictures as well?
No.
Okay.
This was back when my camera had self-destructed.
Yeah.
And also I was so busy that I didn't really take the time.
Okay,
so the old Sierra Club highlight trip in the Sierras typically was move a day, have a layover day. You'd spend two nights at the first camp, have a layover day, move another day, spend two nights and have a layover day, and keep doing that for 1 or 2 weeks, depending on the trip.
Okay.
And so this worked very well for me because I got the group down there. It was just perfect weather and good group. Enjoyed them a lot. Then the next day was a layover day for them, and I took only 2 days of food, packed it down to the mouth of Indian Canyon, where our next camp was going to be.
Okay.
And we were then going to come back to Parashant and have the long day out. So there were really just two camps down in there made up the week.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So, and people had the option on the layover day. They could just lay around and take it easy. They could hike up along the Colorado. They could go back up into Parashant. They could do whatever they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, recuperate. Because on every trip I found later years, in first of spring, everyone's enthused to go out and be hiking again, but at the end of the first day, a lot of the seasoned hikers were really dragging to get in there because they were out of shape. And
yeah,
and
is a long walk.
The layover of the day was very helpful.
Yeah,
but the next day was very eventful for me, and I'll never forget it because I was down there packing by myself. The trip leader and another guy that was on the trip helped a lot for actually organizing the group, getting their gear, and helping me load it on the mules and horses and all.
Okay.
But I had mentioned how when my friends Mel Heaton and David Johnson and I had set up the Moccasin Tours for Whitmore, David's job was to get livestock. He was a horse trader and a good one. And he would go over in the Navajo Reservation or up into Utah and oftentimes bought 3 or 4 horses at a time or traded. But they did a lot of trading back then.
Hmm.
And whenever he was always supposed to be on the lookout for good livestock for me. And so most trips, I had 2 or 3 new untried animals. And hopefully at least one of them would really fit in and seem to enjoy it, and I just immediately I'd want to have him join the string or her or it.
Mm-hmm.
And there were always 2 or 3 that didn't. They were, especially I found out, and he agreed with me, David, that I wanted old, calm horses that would plug along all day.
Right.
And mule. None of this cutting horse stuff that just races around the corral and cutting the calves off from the cows, and this great burst of speed, almost like a racehorse. Because if I took them down in the on the pack trip, they would just quit after the first couple hours.
Oh, wow.
They had just exhausted. And just, and it was psychologically, they were, you know, not bred for this type of activity I had. And I early on got a, David got a roan horse, kind of a mature one. He was a big horse, and I rode him for, well, for the next 7 years.
Wow.
And because he would go all day, very strong, just plodded along. We always got where we were going, and he was very sensible and responded to what we made a team, I have to say. But anyway, on this trip, I had a one new horse that the first day was not, I had, was leery about, because it was, I would just call it like a Palomino. It was a blonde, young, very skitterish, scared to death horse that when I put the pack on, it accepted the pack, but it was really had a hard time coming down the canyon and back and going down again. So I put kind of the lighter load on that one and just kept an eye on her. But on the first day down along the river, when I by myself took the string, and I had to take them all because none of them would be left behind. They all went. That was one of the positive things. They just all stayed together and went together, and I really didn't have to tie them up and lead them at all. I just, especially the mules, followed my roan horse.
Okay.
And wouldn't let him out of their sight.
So, so you wouldn't have to string them together. They would all just go with.
Right.
Nice.
Right, and they had worked out their own place in the line, and you know, after everything was organized and going down the canyon or down the trail, I'd look back and yeah, they were all in their places.
Okay.
And they didn't like to be put, you know, it's in a different order. But this new horse, and I was patient, and I always was very patient, but I was really having a hard time. This was a first experience, not only the canyon, but the being in a group of seasoned mules and horses. And I started west along the river there, and there was excellent burrow trails, because this was still the time when the burrows just overwhelmed the Western Canyon.
Okay.
There were thousands of them, and they had, and I had seen before that, you know, the only places I had successfully backpacked along the Colorado was in the western part where there were burrow trails. And so we went west, and this blonde, the new horse, she really held back and kind of ran back and forth and got in the way and refused to go over the harder places, and very emotional about the whole thing, dancing around. And I finally took the, I stopped and took the pack saddle off of her because I didn't even have any, I didn't pack anything on her. I think only two or three of the mules had packs on. And I put my saddle on her and put the pack and on the roan horse, who was really mortified, but but anyway, then I rode this new horse, and that seemed to be okay until we came around maybe a mile or two down from Parashant, and there was quite a tail of slope coming from the cliff up there down to the river.
Okay.
And from a distance, it looked just totally impassable, of just huge boulders piled up along there. But I was following the burro trail, and sure enough, when we got there, found where the trail was going to go through the talus, the boulder's talus. The horse would not go. It just stopped it, and it was like a wall of boulders that, you know, she clearly decided that was the end. She was not going any further. And I basically had to get this food down to Indian Canyon and come back. So I left the new horse there and led the pack string. I led my roan, who then the others followed, around the corner, and I thought, well, as soon as we get over the hill here, the horse will, you know, figure out not be left behind and come working her way over there and let her do it at her own pace and,
mm-hmm.
and all. And so she did, I could hear her over there just neighing and calling and just stomping back and forth and calling more. She wouldn't come, and so I just had to go. So we went kind of around this big talus slope into the next little draw there and kept going, and just said, well, so I'll get down to Indian and back, and then I'll deal with that horse. Well, I could keep hearing her having fits. And at one point, we were maybe 3 or 4 miles down, at least 3 miles down the canyon. I hear her again, and the string stops, and they all look across the river. And there she is running down the south bank.
Oh, my gosh.
Of the Colorado. And she had gladly caught up with us, but not in a very practical place.
On the other side of the river. Oh, my gosh.
Yes, and she had swam the river, and from where I looked at it, I probably went through a rapid, but they weren't big rapids there.
Right.
There was things, but, and of course, carrying my saddle with her.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, no.
I wasn't too happy, but nothing I could do. The rest of us, you know, my mules and horse were so expressive because they turned and they looked over at her, and they all but shook their head like saying, what an idiot.
I can just see them looking at that horse and looking back at you.
Yes, like, what is this? And so we went around, and I cached the food up Indian Canyon a little ways. And then I came back, and as we went upstream there, the horse followed along the other side, coming back upstream. And when I went around the last big talus pile there, who's there standing in the trail but the horse and my saddle and dripping with water.
Wow.
She had swim the the river back again.
Wow. And not only swam back, but on upstream of the Talus cone.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
This is a smart horse.
Yes. So, the next day, of course, we had the move to make.
Right.
Down to Indian Canyon. And I'm trying to remember, because the horse never made it to Indian Canyon. I left it there without my saddle at Ferrochant, and she seemed to be pretty stable and happy there. And we all moved around, and I kept waiting for her to come running down the opposite shore, but she never did that day. And we had a really good visit there at Indian Canyon. The group hiked up and the canyon down the riverside and just enjoyed that area.
Nice.
Because it was a very nice hike all about it. And then the next day we moved back to Ferrochant, and horse was there and greeted us, and the group had a good time, and then, took it easy and then prepared for the long hike out, because they knew it was going to be a ways and falling water and all of that. But then I had the feeling that, well, I hope she'll come out. And I packed her with a couple sacks of horse feed. And on the way out, I led her behind the roan that I was driving. The other animals just came fine. They were kept pushing her from behind.
Hmm. Okay.
We got to one place kind of down where it's just below that copper line that's over there.
Okay.
But there was a steep kind of sloping. They didn't have to jump up onto a ledge, but it was steep and rock, bare rock there. And she absolutely refused. Just put all four things in front of her, would not move, would not be dragged, and I didn't want to hurt her.
Mm-hmm.
But I unpacked her, and in this case, left her, and I really, really hoped that she would come by herself when the group went around. She just didn't want to be left and would follow. And I also knew that she definitely knew where the river was down the canyon.
Right.
And I just needed to get out, and unfortunately we get out, and there's the whole group gets their gear, and we all say goodbye, and they drive off up to Bundyville and wherever they're going home, and had a great trip of it. But I get out there without a horse, and the other factor to it was the fact that my son John had been born about 2 weeks before this trip, and I had set it up a year in advance, and I had gone on the trip even though Sharon was home, her mother was there, John was fine, but I wanted to get home that afternoon, and I had already agreed that I was going to leave the horses there at the corral where there was water and go home and then come back with the stock truck and get them out of there.
Okay.
So I zoomed home. Everything was fine. I zoomed back, and I still no horse. And to this day, I told the Bundys, they loved the whole story. They could picture every step of the way. And I just made the agreement for them to tell everybody that if somebody finds that horse, they can have her. And I just bring her by, and I'll sign the papers to release the brand on her. But I can't use her, and I'm not going to spend weeks down in there looking for her. And I guess the Bundys did go down and look a couple times, but didn't see her. The other thing I mentioned to all the boat river trip people that I knew,
right,
is said when you're down around Parashant to Indian Canyon, look for a blonde mare with a bunch of donkeys, because she'd pick up with them right away, I was sure. And I then said, you know, I also look for a mule, because with the horse, the mare, and the donkeys, nature takes its course, and you end up with a mule.
Hmm.
And actually, a couple of river pilots called me and said, we saw your horse, and it was exactly that. It was either downstream from Indian Canyon or upstream, and kind of in the middle of a herd of burros. They didn't see any mule, but, and that went for, I know she's lived down there at least 3 years.
Wow.
And the, I went on, you know, busily having other pack trips, and if the Bundys couldn't find her, I knew I wasn't going to find her down in there. So that was an eventful thing that I really remember that trip. And, you know, there's so many unexpected things.
What was your roan's name?
The roan?
Yeah, did you have a name for that horse?
No, it was Roan Horse.
Okay.
That's what I'd call him. Come here, Roan. You know, and he and I had a very close and spectacular, we did a lot of things. See, he loved being the lead. The mules, like I said, would not leave his sight when we were in the mountains and the Uintas and the Wind Rivers. All of those trips, all I had to do was stake him out in the meadow overnight, and the mules would just run all over and graze all over, and they would never stay out of his sight. In the morning, eventually, they just all came over for their oats and ready to go for the next day's packing. As long as I had the roan under control, and he didn't like to run off anyway, so.
Alan, can you explain to me that bit of animal behavior? How is it that the mules would well, it's almost like they're seeking protection from the roan.
They just have an attraction to a horse.
Okay.
The mules. It was every one of them, you know. They, after a trip or two, they were just part of the group, and they literally would not let the mule out of their, the roan out of their sight. And the other even better part of the roan was that he was willing to go anywhere I wanted to go.
Nice.
In very bizarre places, and the canyon and around. And
cool.
But he and I had an understanding, and I remember once that, you know, the hiking trip to Rainbow Bridge.
Yes. Yes.
And where you come in the bridge canyon and you go through what's the Redbud Pass.
Yep.
And down the north side of Redbud Pass, the trail was really, really bad.
Yes.
And there was basically just a stack of huge boulders there, size of trucks. And I was really proud of my string, because the way we approached that is the roan and I would ride up and look over the edge down at this pile of huge boulders, and he'd turn around and look at me, and I'd tell him, I talked to him a lot, I said, yeah, that's where we're going. But he had this thing where when it got really rough, he expected me to get off.
Right.
He would, and he would follow me.
And would you do that? Would you get off?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And I didn't want to ride down that horrendous thing where he was leaping from boulder to boulder.
Got it.
Down 3 or 4 feet at a time.
Or skidding down steep slope.
It was just jumping from rock to rock going down.
Hmm.
And so I would tie the reins up, and then I would jump down, and I'd look at him and kind of wave and say, come on, this is it. And then I had to keep on my feet because he was coming.
Right.
And a place like that, I had to be out of his way. And so I would jump to a rock, and then he would jump behind me, and I had to be down to the next rock. And we got about halfway down there, and all the mules, I look back up, and there's this line of mules all looking over the edge at me. And the one that was the head mule and the second or first in the string, and they were all, you know, tied loose. And he would just step forward and jump down after the roan, and then all the others would just jump in line one after the other.
Okay.
And down at the bottom, we'd come out.
Wow.
And the only time I messed up the roan, and it was one of the, it might have been that same first trip into Rainbow Bridge on the Southway with all the stock, and that was a Sierra Club trip too.
And do you remember what year that was?
That one could have been 80s, it would be 76, 77, something
okay.
like that. It was probably the last livestock pack horse trip into around Navajo Mountain, because it was pretty rough there. My staff track group did it well, but a couple of days before, when I packed the food in from the old Rainbow Lodge at Navajo Mountain on the south side, and came into, we went down Bridge Canyon and camped there.
Okay.
The first camp, and people, you know, hiked down to Bridge Canyon to the junction with whatever. But Anasazi, I guess it is.
Or Aztec, yeah, something like that.
asthma tendon. But anyway, coming around the north slope of Navajo Mountain there, before you make the switchbacks down into the canyon, there's mm-hmm. still snow on the trail.
Oh, wow.
And that didn't bother them too much. What about 100 yards along the way, what I hadn't realized, and I was walking definitely, he took a couple steps and stopped and looked at me with the expression that, okay, this is the way, this is when you need to get off. And the other thing I liked was there on the side of the mountain, it was really steep, so I had to step off him on the right side, which was the side you didn't get on and off a horse, but he didn't mind, and it probably made sense to him. So I started down the trail on foot, and he was coming behind me. And I didn't realize that under this smooth thing of snow, there were boulders and potholes. And when I stepped through one, and suddenly I was down, you know, to my waist in the snow, and down in this probably 2 foot deep hole.
Wow.
And the other thing, by coincidence, I remember it was the first trip of the season, because I had my spurs on, because that was another game that the roan played with me. The first day of the season, when I saddle him up and get going, he would buck up twice, stand up on his back feet, and I would have to step off. And I don't, you know, that, and then I'd get on and we'd ride away. The other thing, what I found that worked, was having a pair of spurs on, which all the cowboys wore all the time. I didn't, because I, you know, I had hiking boots. I wasn't in cowboy boots. But the first day, just as a tradition, I'd always wear the spurs. And when I got back on, you know, it was with the spurs that I would just touch him on the sides, and he'd walk off, and that was, it was over. Everything was back to business. But going down around the mountain there in the snow, I still had my spurs on, which was stupid, because he came down, you know, at his regular pace, and he stepped right over me and stopped. So his front legs are on the trail in front of me. His back leg is down in the hole, standing on my spur.
Oh, wow.
And I'm just hunched down under his belly. And he didn't move an inch, fortunately. And I just talked to him, you know, explained that the stupid things I could do in the first day, but I was worse than they were. And it took me quite a while, a couple of minutes, to undo the strap on the spur so I could then get my foot, well, of course, get the spur out from under his foot, and then I could work my foot out from under his, and he could carefully lift his hoof that was holding me down up and hold it up while I got out from under there. And then I, you know, pet him and talk to him. And I, all this time, the mule string is right back there along the trail, all but laughing at me. They were, you know, like, this was great fun. And we then had an uneventful day getting down there and packing back and forth. We went over Redbud Pass and down that stretch twice, because I moved the food and then brought the group. And it was interesting. I tried something there when we got down where Red Bud hit the canyon there, above Rainbow Bridge. We went down a couple miles and found a really good campsite and then spent a day, and people went to the bridge and back. But there was a little side canyon alcove there, and I, as an experiment, brought an electric fence and a little battery.
Oh.
And put that up across the mouth of that draw, and I really wanted to confine the stock, because you know, they could really make a mess of a place, and I was pretty sensitive to that, and it worked very well. They understood what the electric fence was, and they just stayed up in their little, was quite a big corral, but it worked very well with them.
Cool.
So anyway, back to
How many times did you lead pack trips into Parashant down to Indian Canyon?
That was the only one.
Okay.
I led one pack trip into, well, I actually led two into Thunder River, to Peace Creek, Thunder River, to Nab. The first time I took I was a friend of everybody along the way. When he heard that we were doing pack trips, he asked that he'd always wanted to see Tapete's Creek and Thunder River Falls. And could he take he and his sons, and we knew him. He was Dr. Washburn from Page, and we ended up really knowing him well over the years. And he and his four or five sons, and David and I and Mel and all the stock, we took them into Tapete's Creek and spent a couple days, and they hiked up and down, and I went fishing, and we hauled them out. And then after that, I had that one very involved trip where the packers took us down to the Peach, and then we walked around to Deer Creek, and they carried all the gear over to the upper part of Surprise Valley, I guess they called it, where Deer Creek Spring comes out.
Right.
And we camped up there. And then we hiked down the Colorado to the mouth of Kanab Canyon. We backpacked the group, and the packers went out the trail and down Mountain Sheep, what is that canyon, into Kanab from the east. Why don't I remember?
Is that Indian Canyon?
No, it's
Scotty's.
Quite a big canyon.
Jump Up or Scotty's Hollow?
Jump Up.
Jump Up, okay.
Jump Up. And then we spent one night with a backpack night at the mouth of Kanab, and then went up to Scotty's Hollow where we met the pack string that had all the gear and foods. And that was really all the packing I did there in the Grand Canyon. I was concerned with the impact of the pack string.
Ah.
For one thing, and then the Park Service, when I started that, was still Grand Canyon National Monument, and then Lake Mead all the way to from Whitmore west, because the right. concession I had at Whitmore was from Lake Mead. And so...
But after 1975, with the enlargement of Grand Canyon National Park, all that land would have then suddenly become under the management of Grand Canyon.
Yeah, and, you know, I just had a lot of other neat places I could go.
Huh.
And I really thought that it wasn't appropriate to be encouraging pack stock down in the canyon.
Okay.
You know, a horse and a mule for me with my camera, yeah, that was fun, and we definitely didn't have any impact, but to have 8 or 10 animals for a week, it was hard not to impact the area, and so I just felt like I'd go other places.
Well, gosh, when you lost that blonde horse, I mean, I would assume that was your profits for that trip gone.
Yeah, right.
So well, it's not without its consequences to you as well.
Yeah, yeah. So that's Parashant, more than you wanted.
Oh, that's a great recounting. Yeah.
I mainly mention it because it shows, you know, sort of the stages you go through in my education and the livestock's education and my friends that were getting the stock for me, they got more and better and better at picking stuff that would really work. And then the last 5 years or so that I did it, I was really happy with my pack string.
Hmm. And this was from roughly 1975 to 1985?
No, it was earlier than that. It was in the late 60s.
Okay.
As we started, and by 78, I went down to Tucson to get a teaching degree. We lived in Fredonia. My wife taught at the school in Fredonia. We knew all the teachers, and I just decided that was going to be the direction to go, mainly because our son was ready to be start school. We had the second, our daughter came, and I just really, the idea of being gone a month at a time, all spring and summer and fall, really was getting harder to justify.
Right.
And 70, the end of the season in 78, I guess, is when I sold the whole kit and caboodle of the stock truck, the horses, the mules, the pack saddles, the everything to the Bundys.
Huh.
And they, I don't know if they ever used it down Whitmore. They had talked about that, but I went down to Tucson, and I had thought that, well, if I'm teaching, I can take a trip or two in the summer, put it in the mountains, but that never worked. And we went backpacking up in the mountains as a family, but nothing with horses.
Okay.
So.
When did you get a teaching certificate then from the University of Arizona?
Yes.
When did you complete that?
I'm trying to think. 79, I graduated the summer of 79 with a teaching certificate.
Okay.
And started work in Page that August. In fact, I was teaching up there before I graduated from Tucson, but they had a special way that if you had good grades, they'd pretend like you had, well, they'd give you a provisional certificate to know that, and that you'd get it eventually. So I was already up in Page teaching. And I, like I mentioned before, that the first time in probably 10 years, there was not an open teaching spot in Fredonia the year I graduated.
Yeah, I was going to say, because Sharon's nicely teaching in Fredonia, but that's what, 2 hours from Page, or an hour and a half?
Hour and a half.
Okay.
Yeah, that was not feasible. She had substitute taught down in Tucson, and then when I got the, when there wasn't anything available, and Fredonia, we noticed Page was advertising for several teachers, elementary teachers.
Oh.
We had, that's what my degree was. And I met with the guy, and it was no problem because, well, we knew lots of people in Page. Many of the younger generation, our generation from Fredonia, had gotten jobs at the power plant and the dam. And, so we knew lots of couples, and there we felt very comfortable, and we kind of halfway said we'd teach there a year, and when something became available, we'd move back to Fredonia, because we had property and a house there. But turned out, everything really worked well in Page, and we sold the house and stayed in Page and bought a house there and stayed there for almost 30 years.
You know what? Maybe this is a good place to put a comma in this interview series, and next time you can tell us about life in Page.
Well, I was thinking that too, because there are a lot of other stories here and there, but this is kind of a place to put the period on Grand Canyon, the effect it had on my early life, and the fact that by default I was exploring and trying different ways to not use the canyon, but not in that great commercial sense. It was had other, I think, good motives for being there and interpreting it and getting it well known. And,
and
all of that. So maybe if we could put a period there, and
that'll close that chapter, and we'll open up another one.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Great. Well, with that, this will conclude part 12 of A Grand Canyon Oral History with Alan Malmquist. Today is Friday, March 10th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Alan, thank you so very much.
You're welcome. This has really been a pleasure. Thanks again.
I really enjoyed it, too. Hang on.